This is BBC Radio 3. A very good afternoon from me, John Shea, with you this Boxing Day. In an hour's time, the Early Music Show continues its look back at the past year on the programme. Catherine Bott and Lucy Skeeping are here just after the 1 o'clock news. And Chichi Nwanaku presents more of your Radio 3 requests between 2 and 4 this afternoon. Now, though, it's 12 midday. Time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Today I welcome the actress, comedian and now psychologist Pamela Stevenson Connolly. Many of you, I'm sure, like me, will remember her from the 1980s comedy hit Not the 9 o'clock News, in which she starred alongside Rowan Atkinson, Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones. Nowadays, she's probably better known for her psychotherapy column in The Guardian and her recent series of television interviews, Shrink Wrap. But at this particular moment, Pamela is actually taking part, as you doubtless know, in this year's Strictly Come Dancing competition. And by the time the programme goes out, Pamela, we will know the results. But today, as we sit here, you've just come from rehearsals.
I have a slightly sore body, but I'm looking forward to my cha-cha that I'm doing tomorrow.
Did you ever think you could do it? I mean, maybe you were a good enough dancer to know that you could manage something.
No, it's completely mad. It's completely insane to even contemplate doing something like that. But it just seemed like fun, and I was in a place where I was just feeling that it would be good to do something very frivolous. Mm-hmm. And frivolous it is. It's also hard work. It's also something that takes the body to a whole new level. It just is enormous fun, though.
As you speak now, you in fact have done very well. I mean, you've looked perhaps closest to a professional dancer in some of the episodes.
Goodness me, I can't believe this.
Well, that's what has been said.
Well, no, I
not
mean...
Not just by me, because I'm not a great judge, but...
I have a tendency to teeter.
Yes.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with teetering. After all, none of us are supposed to be able to do this at all. But I had polio when I was a child, and I was sent to ballet class when I was 5 with my 2 sisters. We all had polio, and we were all sent to strengthen our limbs. So ballet's a little bit, I think, like learning Latin, that you can then have quite a good grounding for other European languages. Ballet, if you sort of learn a little bit about where your limbs go and where they are in relation to the rest of your body, then you can probably sort of take a stab at other forms of dancing and do okay.
Some people might think that it's a huge leap to go from comedy, which I imagine you had a great time, to psychology. But in fact, it's not perhaps such a great leap. After all, the human condition and laughing at it, and it's, you know, life is stranger than fiction quite often. And so it perhaps was quite a natural...
Thank you. You get it. Yeah, absolutely. To me, it wasn't a switch at all. It was a very comfortable... Well, it's never comfortable to let go of one career and move to another one. But having said that, I mean, I have been interested in psychology for many, many years. I mean, when I was a comedian, I was... Oh, gosh, I read Primal Scream, Yanov's Primal Scream. I remember reading that when I was a teenager. So it just seemed like a natural thing, an examination of human behaviour, just a slightly different take on it.
Mm. And have you found it, and doing that column, very rewarding? Because you come across all aspects of human life and sometimes in considerable misery, but have you sort of felt that it's been rewarding in a way that perhaps just performing is not? Because you can actually help people in their lives to overcome quite serious problems which are making them miserable.
Absolutely. It's enormously rewarding, and I do enjoy psychological work, psychotherapy in particular, very, very much. But you're quite right. I mean, the past year, I've really seen a lot of the dark side of human nature in some of the counselling that I've done in sort of disaster areas and conflict zones, such as the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. And so I was pretty ready for a little break, and Strictly fit the bill.
Well, your first choice has actually got a psychological dimension to it, hasn't it?
Indeed.
Music from La Sonnambula by Bellini.
Yes, I mean, sleep and dreaming in particular. It's more important to certain types of psychologists than to others, but I happen to be one of those who thinks that dreams are very important, and I'm fascinated by Freud said the royal road to the unconscious. And I always loved the idea of the sleeper and the sleepwalker in particular, somebody who's expressing something not just in a dream state but also physically. And I also always, for many, many years, I've loved this aria. I tried to sing it. I remember going to some singing lessons and trying really hard to sing it and failing so miserably. And it's just one of those challenges I've never managed to meet. But it has not stopped me enjoying the aria. And of course, I grew up in Australia. I'm an Australian citizen. So Joan Sutherland, to me, has been an icon, as she is for many people around the world.
Oh!
What on earth made me think that I could even attempt to sing? Must have been mad. Oh, so beautiful.
Ah, non credea mirati, from La Sonnambula, Act 2, Scene 2, by Bellini. Joan Sutherland sang Amina, Fernando Correna Rodolfo, and the orchestra of the Maggio Musicale Fiorentino was conducted by Richard Bonning. Have you always loved music? I mean, from way back?
I grew up in a household where there was a lot of music, but it was one sort. It was largely church music. My father was choirmaster and organist at our church, and I sang in the choir. My mother sang in the choir. One of my sisters did too. And there would only be that sort of music and just a few other types of classical music. I never really heard anything else until I sort of got much older.
You mentioned those early days in Sydney, and I think it was in Sydney that you almost sort of overheard a piece by Satie, a rather strange piece, which led you to explore a bit more.
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, Satie would never have been played in my house. It probably would have been considered way too frivolous or something. And when I became a teenager, actually probably quite late teens, I mean, sort of 17, 16, 17, something like that, and started going outside the house, and I began to hear music that I probably wasn't meant to hear, Rolling Stones, for example. And I remember hearing people like Leonard Cohen and being deeply, deeply affected by this kind of music and the poetry of people like Bob Dylan and so on. And also, see, this was the 70s, and Australia sort of, well, Sydney, where I grew up, sort of had the 60s and the 70s. You know, it was a little bit, if you imagine London in the 60s, Australia, I think, sort of did that a little bit later. And I remember walking into a near empty house. I'd probably sneaked out of the house. I probably wasn't meant to be where I was. And there was a pianist sitting at a rather out of tune piano playing a piece by Satie. And it was Vexations. It was that piece that you're meant to play 694 times or 680 times or whatever.
Something like 24 hours.
Yes, it takes a really long time. Yeah. And this half-asleep pianist was sort of only up to, you know, 243, and there was somebody waiting to take over. Because I think you're allowed to do it in tandem.
Yeah, no, it was supposed to be a relay team at the very least, yeah.
Well, I think this person had been at his post way too long. Anyway, I just remember being so struck by the wit of this. I hadn't really come across wit and humour in music before. Mm-hmm. And I was so tickled by it. It seemed quite shocking to me at the time, and certainly not something that my father would have approved of. Mm-hmm. But it was a very formative moment.
Well, I think rather than plunge into 624 hours or bars or whatever, we might go for one of the other Satie pieces, one of the gymnopédie.
Well, I do like gymnopédie.
Thank you.
I did actually learn to play that one. And I remember in my early 20s playing it over and over again, very soulfully, after a boyfriend dropped me. It's perfect for that, isn't it?
Gymnopédie number 1 by Satie, and Kerfelek was the pianist. I imagine, Pamela Stevenson, that you probably always rather enjoyed art with a bit of bite, with a bit of edge.
Very true, but it took a while to develop. I mean, when I was in my mid-20s, I set off from Australia, and I travelled sort of quite wildly. Yes.
The boyfriend was long put away by then.
The boyfriend was put away, and parapraxis there. It was definitely a wild journey. And I was exposed to a lot of very edgy theatre, for example. During that nearly a year that I was travelling by myself, different places, came into contact with a lot of street theatre, a lot of satirical theatre. I remember being in Turkey and there was a coup and there was amazing biting satire on at the time. And it was really my first serious exposure to it, and I thought it was very exciting. And it kind of led me into Not the 9 o'clock News. I probably wouldn't have been so interested in being in part of a programme like that had I not become very enthusiastic about topical comedy.
And where I was taking us towards was the world of Bertolt Brecht, who perhaps, with Kurt Weill, wrote the most sort of telling and biting satirical pieces of theatre of that period.
Well, after I started travelling from Australia, I think what was in my mind was to try to see as much of the world, but particularly as many types of theatre around the world as I could. And I ended up in Eastern Europe at one point and managed to wangle myself an invitation to watch rehearsals at the Berliner Ensemble, which of course was Brecht's theatre in East Germany, in East Berlin. They wouldn't let me stay in East Berlin, so I had to stay in West Berlin and cross the wall that was then in place, of course, twice a day, and it was all very Alsatians at the border, kind of stressful. But it was amazing to sit and watch rehearsals and to see how that theatre company operated, how seriously they took the work. And every now and again, there would be a pause in the rehearsal and somebody would put on I hate to say it was probably a gramophone record at that time, and the voice of Brecht would sort of boom out pronouncing on something that they'd been stuck on in rehearsals. And I saw several of the productions that they had going at the time. I just thought they were absolutely amazing. So I've chosen a song from Mahogany, which is a favourite of mine. And I always really admired Lotte Lenya. People like Lotte Lenya, that sort of that edge to the voices. I mean, their voices just, they can be warm, but also very, very chilling. And just the savagery of it comes from a dark place.
Oh, show us the way to the next whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
For we must find the next whiskey bar. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar.
I tell you,
we must die.
Why?
For we must find the next pretty boy. For if we don't find the next pretty boy.
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die.
I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. For if we don't find the next little dollar,
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die.
I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die.
This delightful discordance of it all. It's just wonderful.
That was the Alabama song from Mahogany, words by Brecht, music by Kurt Weill. And we heard Lotte Lenya with an orchestra conducted by Roger Bean. We heard Satie earlier, Pamela, and he used to get into great furies. And according to Poulenc, both Debussy and Ravel suffered as a result of his furious fits. He was actually also very keen on his little top hat and his umbrella, Poulenc said. Anyway, Debussy it is next, and we go in a sense from a deliberate element of crude emotion to something of great finesse and sensibility, and also something which I think suggests to you, because it's probably how you know it, finesse and sensibility in movement.
Yes, and also female fantasy. To me, this is a deeply psychological piece. The ballet, as well, of course, as the music. But I remember seeing this as a child and absolutely loving it. And I've thought a lot about it. This woman is asleep in bed and a fawn comes jumping through the window and she ends up dancing with him. And of course, he's a man. I mean, hello. This is a highly sexual piece. Mm. And yes, expressed in such a refined manner. It's a really evocative piece of music, I think. And I remember that leap that the male dancer had to make through the window at that moment. Just fantastic, just coming together of the music and the dance and this woman's fantasy. And every woman in the audience would just be connecting with this moment, probably privately trying not to, hoping no one will notice just how excited she's getting.
I think for your next anniversary, somebody ought to arrange for that to be played once you've gone to sleep, and then Billy Connolly must leap through the window.
Could I have Nureyev instead?
Does it every year. The prelude, La Prémédie d'un Faune by Debussy, the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by André Previn, and the solo flautist was Peter Lloyd. Well, from that, we turn slightly incongruously, Pamela, to a frog. And I think this was encountered on your journeys too.
From fawns to frogs, it's not such a switch. Well, I spent some time in Bali in Indonesia. This was another early journey that I took. My first experience of being outside Australia by myself and in a very different culture. And it was sort of my first experience of really becoming immersed in a culture. I found Balinese culture to be so fascinating and so beautiful. It's a Hindu island in the midst of largely Muslim islands, but the particular style of Hinduism is very much to do with flowers and scents and beautiful, beautiful dancing. I lived in a small village for a period of time, sort of stayed in the middle of a rice field, and there's a small village there called Pliatan near Ubud, and I used to go along and try to get my fingers into the shapes that the sort of 3 and 4 year old girls were beginning to learn the Balinese dances, and you have to start very, very early or you'll never do it. And they were so delicate and beautiful. And the family that I stayed with, they were musicians. The father was the leader of the gamelan orchestra. And I used to go along to rehearsals. And then one day he said to me, well, since you're here, you better play something. And he taught me to play an instrument that he called a sound frog, simply a piece of bamboo, I suppose, that is shaped in a certain way and you blow into it. It sounds a bit like a frog croaking. I actually love gamelan orchestra. And when I hear it, I just right back in Bali, and because Bali's changed a lot since then. We're talking 40 years ago, really. But in those days when I hardly saw any other Western people, I was just very much wandering around in my sarong through the rice fields and playing with monkeys and playing my sound frog.
Yeah. We've managed to find, actually, to take you back to those days, some Balinese frog song.
I'm amazed. I'm amazed.
Well, here it is. Thank you.
was also my first experience of understanding that there were cultures where art wasn't separated from life. It was really an education in that sense, and I had never really come across it before, but these people who'd be rice farmers in the daytime, at night would be playing in gamelan orchestras, or they would be dancing, or they would be... there was a lot of comedy, masked plays and sort of Laurel and Hardy-type characters that you would see. The festivals of the arts, which were just absolutely naturally coming out of village life, part of village life. Most people who grow up in Western society are not really exposed to that. Are they? They're not. Then they don't really.
Or there's a degree of embarrassment surrounding it if they are, quite often.
Yes, art is something sort of on the side, isn't it? No matter what type of creative work it is, it's something that is sort of in opposition to math and science and sensible things somehow.
Bar-Lise Gamelin performed that frog song. Well, I know reading your books, your biography of Billy Connolly and Brave Mouse, living with him, that life is quite apart from the perceptions you've got about this rather extraordinary man, there's a huge amount of fun.
He can be quite quiet. He can be quite a little bit of a hermit when he's not performing. He likes to play his banjo. I hate it when he plays his banjo. And Billy totally acknowledges that banjo players' wives are driven mad by the circular nature of banjo practicing. It just goes on and never stops. But he absolutely loves those sort of solitary activities, fishing. He started drawing recently. He's doing very interesting drawings. And I think that people who do what he does go out and put themselves through the huge rush of adrenaline that it takes, the scariness of getting up on stage and doing what he does and doing it so brilliantly. I mean, it just takes the most enormous amount of will and energy and physicality and so on. They do need their downtime.
This next piece, I think, is music you probably both enjoy together.
Oh, well, Blazin' Fiddles is a group of fiddlers that hail from Scotland, of course, and I just love them. I first heard them in a local hall near where we live in Scotland, and they took the roof off the place. I mean, just within seconds of their starting, everybody was on their feet, just jumping up and down, just jump, jump, jump. Just the joyfulness of this music. I defy anybody to sit in their chair when this is playing.
Thank you.
That was Strathmarches by Phil Cunningham, and it was played by Blazin' Fiddles. We're going to go back to New Zealand, Pamela, for your last piece. So, in other words, where you began, at least in terms of the artist, the singer.
Well, I was born in New Zealand. I have some Māori blood, and I've always been a great admirer of Kiri Tukanua. And obviously, I have a huge affinity. I feel a huge affinity with Polynesian people. And I think of New Zealand in a very sort of romantic light. I have a very, I suppose, a romantic family history. My great-great-grandfather was sort of lost on a ship, and his son went out from England to try to find out what had happened to him. Didn't achieve that, but ended up establishing a trading post in the northern part of New Zealand and married a Maori woman. And I think about my great-great-grandmother and wonder what it must have been like for her, because she, on the one hand, had an allegiance to her own people, but at the same time, she married a white man. I can't imagine the difficulty of that situation. It must have been very hard.
Well, there's quite a romantic story to the creation of this song by Strauss, because he wrote it for his bride.
How lovely.
And it has a kind of warm embrace to it as you listen to it. It just unfolds very gently, and then the voice creeps in. Morgan by Richard Strauss. Kirita Kanawa was the soprano soloist with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. Tell me, Pamela, when you are doing something that you are trained to do, you know, like acting or comedy or psychotherapy, that's one thing, and you can go out and do it with, if you've got a technique, with relative ease. But when you go out, potentially in front of 12 million people, to do something that you've not actually been trained to do, and you're just doing slightly on the hoof, albeit with a short.
But... on the hoof is a very good way to put it.
I mean, does that feel very different? Are you able to use your kind of acting experience to give a performance as opposed to perhaps just be scared witless?
Well, I'm both scared witless and I have been surprised at how some of the old performing instincts have sort of managed to... I don't know where they've come from, but they have sort of come out a bit, and thank heavens, because they've been much needed. I learned very early on that dance was a very joyous thing, something very special, and that it was a very freeing thing for me. I was a very studious child. I always had my head in a book. There were huge academic expectations placed on me. So dancing was an escape from all of that. And you could say I've sort of come full circle now with the same thing. And so it is an absolute joy to dance. I mean, the fact that I'm being trained to do so by an amazing partner who is getting me to do things I never thought I would have been able to do means that I can almost sort of manage to give a sort of halfway decent performance for a complete novice and enjoy it at the same time. And so I'm very grateful for the experience, really. It's just really fun.
Well, Pamela Stevenson-Connolly, I think all I can say is commiserations if you didn't win, congratulations if you did, but happy Christmas either way.
Thank you, same to you.
Pamela Stevenson-Connolly was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, as the new year begins, next weekend Radio 3 embarks on a 12-day celebration of the music of Mozart. And in next weekend's edition of Private Passions, Michael will be recalling some of his guests over the past 15 years who've chosen Mozart's music, including the writers Michael Dibdin, Michael Morpurgo and Mario Vargas Llosa, and the actors Lenny Henry, Simon Callow and Fiona Shaw. So that's next Sunday's Private Passions at the later time of 2:30 in the afternoon. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and today's programme was produced by Chris Marshall. Now, tomorrow evening sees the return to Radio 3 of Dame Joan Bakewell.
In the first of a new series of Belief, I return to talk about his faith with Tory peer Chris Patton. Having held a whole raft of ministerial jobs under the Conservative government of Mrs. Thatcher, he became, under John Major, the last governor of Hong Kong. He has sustained his Catholic faith throughout, no more significantly than when tackling religious divisions in Northern Ireland. In Hong Kong, he found it assumed even greater relevance. Listen to Chris Patton in Belief with me, Joan Bakewell, at 9:30 tomorrow evening on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. In a couple of minutes, today's edition of The Early Music Show. But now at 1 o'clock, this is John Shea in London with the latest news. Avon and Somerset police say the body found west of Bristol yesterday is that of the missing landscape architect Joanna Yates. Her remains were found near a quarry more than a week after she was last seen. Her death is being treated as suspicious. The government is considering fining airport operators who are not prepared for bad weather. The aviation minister, Theresa Villiers, says it's unacceptable that so many passengers faced cancellations and delays because of this month's heavy snow. The airport's operator, BAA, says it welcomes legislation designed to improve the experience for passengers. The Pope has condemned as absurd attacks on churches in Nigeria and the Philippines on Christmas Day. Six people died in Nigeria, a similar number were hurt in the Philippines. In an address in St. Peter's Square at the Vatican, Pope Benedict said Christians were the most persecuted religious group in the world. A series of strong earth tremors has hit New Zealand. They followed an earthquake of magnitude 7.3, which struck near the South Pacific island of Vanuatu, generating a small tsunami. The shocks damaged buildings in Christchurch and cut power supplies, but no one was hurt. Retailers across the country are hoping for a busy day at the start of the post-Christmas sales. Large discounts are being offered in the high street to make up for the losses caused by the recent severe weather. The forthcoming rise in VAT is expected to lead to a brisk trade in furniture and big electronic items. England's cricketers have made a strong start to the fourth Ashes test in Melbourne. After bowling Australia out for 98 runs, England's batsmen ended the day on 157 without loss. And the weather, it's a clear day in England, with clouds spreading south and east from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. England will remain dry, but other parts will see some rain or snow. It'll remain below freezing in southern Scotland, eastern and northern England. Other areas will be slightly warmer. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02 past 1. So, in an hour's time, Chichin Wanuku is here with more of your Radio 3 requests. That's at 2 o'clock and it's followed at 4 o'clock by Choral Evensong. Now, though, the Boxing Day edition of the Early Music Show. Here are Lucy Skeeping and Catherine Bott.
Well, hello again and welcome to our Boxing Day edition of the Early Music Show.
Hope the Christmas dinner went well and Santa Claus came up with all the goods that you longed for and hopefully not too many sore heads this morning.
Well, I hope that if you spent it with the family, everyone's still on speaking terms, and if you spent Christmas alone, you did exactly what you liked all day, she said with feeling. Now, we're taking another chance in today's programme to revisit some of our highlights from the past year on the Early Music Show, and we're going to look forward a bit to some of the potential highlights of next year, 2011. There'll be music as well as us, of course, on the way, and we've chosen some nice festive stuff to play you. We're in central London in Purcell territory. What better place to be recording?
And he was sent from the grave.
Christmas Day anthem by Purcell. Well, as yesterday's programme, as Kate said, we're in London today. We're still in the party mood here in this cosy wine bar. But of course, over the past year, we've been out and about quite a bit in order to bring you the very best, or at least some of the most interesting music stories and interviews for the Early Music Show. Now, one thing I particularly enjoyed was spending the day at Dartington Hall over the summer in what was Gavin Henderson's last year as artistic director. I've performed there lots of times with my own bands, and I've even run courses, so I know it quite well. And, you know, what makes Dartington such a great place is the fact that the students or the participants sort of mingle with the artists and get to chat to them over lunch and so on, as well as then going on to see their concerts. The concert I went to was given by the Dufai Collective. It was at Dartington's fabulous medieval hall with those marvellous acoustics or wooden beams. The concert actually featured 17th century music in the first half, songs that have their roots in the English tradition, including Thomas Ravenscroft's version of The Three Ravens, which I think was published in the first decade of the 17th century. This is one of those songs that's actually impossible to date. Originally came from Scotland, it's thought. It's a very sad song about chivalry, about a dead knight whose body is carried away by a doe who then dies herself. But it's also supposed to represent the death of Christ. It's really beautiful and very moving. This is Vivian Ellis with the Dufai Collective.
There were three ravens set on a tree, dead.